Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is an episode in the Sundance series. I'm very happy to welcome Alyssa Wilkinson of the New York Times.
Hello, it's good to be here.
So this has been, I guess, a different experience because you've been going to Sundance for a number of years now, but this one's a remote edition for you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I feel like we did have 2 years of forced remote editions during the pandemic. So it's a familiar feeling to watch them in my house. Although some of them have, of course, also screened in the many screening rooms of New York City. And I saw you at one of them.
Indeed. And we'll talk about that one, for which for me was actually, like, I have to say, like a highlight.
Yeah, I agree.
Fiction or nonfiction either. Well, from what you've seen so far, what you've gleaned, or do you have any like general state of Sundance or like observations about the lineup or anything?
Yeah, I mean, from afar, so I should say I've only seen, well, with one small exception, I've only seen documentaries as of right now. And I think that will hold until their digital platform opens for general viewing. And it's kind of interesting this year that the digital platform, which last year was very helpfully available throughout the entire festival to press, which meant that if you had like a spare weird period of time and wanted to go back to your condo and knock out a movie, you could. This year, those are only becoming available Wednesday morning, which has meant, I mean, and this is probably pretty specific to my case, but has rendered it kind of useless for me because of deadlines and things like that. So I hope that they reconsider that in the future or maybe how it's handled. But that means that all the things that I'm learning about fiction are from people's tweets, essentially. And it feels like there's been a lot of buzz around a lot of films. Like, it's actually kind of exciting to watch. I don't know that we're going to get like $30 million buys or anything like that, but you know, there's a bunch of movies that I'm excited to see. And it seems like there's a lot of movies with Kristen Stewart and Jesse Eisenberg and a couple other people seem to really be around a lot, but those are all people I like. So that makes me happy. But, you know, on the documentary side, I've been watching as much as I can get my hands on and feels like there's always kind of two variety of Sundance documentary. Mm-hmm. There's like the, you know, labor of love movie that took people 7 or 8 years to make. And it's really carefully crafted and well thought out and often kind of pushing boundaries of like fiction and nonfiction or, you know, observational things like that. And then there's usually a bunch of biographical documentaries, essentially. And those are a bunch of those, and they are harder to get to see early because they are playing them a little closer to the chest. I guess, you know, the reason for that probably is commercial in nature. But that pattern has held again this year. And it was true years ago. I was on the jury for the US documentary.
Oh, yeah.
In 2019. And, you know, we had a very similar experience. And, you know, that's fine. There's all kinds of people in the world and all kinds of documentaries in the world. But it's funny to kind of watch it happen every year and be like, oh, yep, this is the pattern.
Yeah, it's something that, you know, it just reminds me of, sometimes it seems like filmmakers need some kind of, I mean, it seems unfair to call that a hook, to have it be about a famous person. But I mean, it's an easy way to describe your movie. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, if people are curious or interested in the person, you know, like I imagine a movie, like there's Superman is a, mm-hmm. you know, for example, a movie that people would know what you're talking about, you know.
Yes. So. Yes, or mine is the movie about, you know, Frida Kahlo, which I haven't seen it yet, so I can't really speak to it. But, you know, okay, I know who that is. There's a number of those. It is funny, though, I was kind of thinking about that in tandem with how biopics, a word I hate, but in the more like fictionalized mainstream world are going. And if you look at the ones that are up for Oscars or whatever this year, they are a little less traditional in their approach to their subjects and to the stories they're telling. And so, I don't know, maybe nonfiction will catch up at some point. But at this point, it seems like, you know, there's still a lot of, well, we're making this movie because we have the footage and the people are still alive and we can talk to them. And,
right,
you know, there's value in that quite literally to streamers and they buy them.
Yeah, no, definitely. This reminds me, I was kind of nursing a little theory in the other direction too, which is that, I don't know, over the weekend at Sundance, I was wondering, were documentaries, and the reason I thought this is because it seemed like there were fewer like conventional, for lack of a better word, dramas. Mm-hmm. You know, I was watching a lot of dramas, comedies or mixes of the two that had some kind of sort of tricksy kind of narrative thing they were doing, or a science fiction streak to it. And, you know, I'm not judging it either way, but it almost seemed to me that the space taken by, or the itch scratched by conventional dramas is being done by documentaries to a certain extent.
Yeah, that's such an interesting point. And, at this point of flux that we're in the industry, that would make a lot of sense. And it did seem like every drama or every kind of scripted film I was hearing about had some kind of wild, violent streak or like weird premise or something like that. So, which is not totally unusual for Sundance, but usually you're right. There's more of like, oh, it's a heartwarming tale of X. And I did not hear heartwarming tale of anything applied to anything that premiered over the weekend, though, of course, I'm getting a very limited sampling. So who knows?
Well, actually, I would love to start with a documentary that, after I saw it, like a publicist said, "Yeah, it's heartwarming," and I immediately kind of recoiled because that wasn't my reaction to it. It felt like realer than that word tends to suggest, and I'm not like criticizing the person at all, but that always just generally sensitive right after a movie anyway. But that was the documentary "Look Into My Eyes," which is the latest documentary from Lana Wilson.
Yeah, I mean, Lana has such an interesting career. I think she until a certain pop star entered her orbit, I think she was best known for After Tiller, which is still, I think, kind of a towering achievement of a documentary about doctors who perform late-term abortions and sort of what they face. But of course, she made a Miss Americana, which I was at that premiere at Sundance a few years ago, and so was Taylor Swift, the subject of the film, which was a big deal then and probably even a bigger deal now. She made but that's that's a good portrait of an artist. She made the Brooke Shields series. I don't remember if that was two or three episodes last year. So this one feels like a little bit return to some. Oh, she also made a film years ago about a Buddhist monk and death, basically. So this feels much more in the line of those films where it's kind of unconventional and exploring. People keep asking me what it's about, and I'm like, it's about psychics. and in New York City, oh well, what about them? And I'm like, hard to explain exactly. Obviously, I don't want to like give everything away about the film because I really do feel like the joy of this film, the joy, the interest comes from how it unfolds in front of you. But I remember her advertising actually to say, does anybody want to see a psychic and let me film them? And she, this, obviously it was months ago, and I thought, what are you doing, Lana? And then this is what she was doing. So it starts out with people, trying to contact the dead or ask questions of lost loved ones or find out about the future from people who are psychics. And I really thought the next step was going to be talking to the people who are seeking these answers and sort of a movie about the human search for meaning. And it just went off in a completely different direction. It's about the people who are doing the contacting and why and how they got there. I don't know. There were a lot of things I thought were really fascinating about this film, but I want to know what you thought.
I really like this film. I almost surprised myself by how much I got lost in it in a good way. And I think just part of it is just I was stunned by the ability of the film to show people in their vulnerability and their kind of lostness, and also just the really specific filmmaking decisions that were making all of that possible, which aren't like in your face, but on reflection, I was like, oh, so this is what happens if you are finding this particular editing rhythm that isn't like deadpan, it isn't like punchliney, it isn't like lingering too long. I just was amazed by that. Or like framing and lighting interviews. Like these are all like technical decisions that lead. And it's not, again, it's not stuff you're conscious of, or I wasn't really so conscious of it, but that's what helps create this space. And even what she's talking to them about, it's not like she's approaching the psychics as if they are, you know, these authorities from the great beyond. She's approaching them like, I guess, all of us, these damaged human beings, you know, and just hearing them out, and just giving them the space to talk. And first and foremost, like these sessions, you're just face to face with people. I mean, and that's also just very intense, and you can kind of forget the power of that. Like, it's funny that talking head is like a cliche is like a cliche.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting to see the power restored to that in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all talking. The movie is just people sort of asking questions and explaining themselves. There's a sequence a little into it that was so fascinating to me because, of course, the movie has no stated thesis. I don't think text ever appears on screen. You know, you're kind of just wondering where she's leading you. And of course, I think for a lot of viewers, not all viewers, but a lot of viewers, the question definitely is going to be, is this a con? You know, are these people just making everything up? Is this real? And the movie, I don't think, ever tries to answer the real question. I think it's more about what does that question even mean? And there's a sequence where you slowly come to realize that everyone involved has a background in theater. But that doesn't mean that this is like fake, but they do freely admit that there's some performance involved. And you know, that's kind of interesting. And there's a moment near the end that's, I think, genuinely startling and fascinating. But I think just sort of the gentleness of the film is really disarming in a way that then comes back and kind of wallops you at the end because, you know, like all good humanisty kind of documentaries, it's just about like, what does it mean to be human and like live this life with other people? But it's such an interesting lens into all of those questions.
Yeah, for sure. It is like therapy in a way. I mean, what they're doing, but it's something beyond that because it has expectations that therapy isn't really trying or equipped to provide. And what's amazing, yeah, is that you might go into it as if it's you're going to try to figure out whether this is really happening, whether these people are really clairvoyant. But I feel like the movie kind of neatly and nimbly just kind of sidesteps that basically. It's less about believing and it's more about feeling what they're feeling. And that's, it's such a smart and empathetic thing to approach it that way. And it's not also not to say, I guess if you hear our descriptions, it could sound like it's self-serious a little bit, but it has a sense of humor, I think, and the
Completely.
people in it have senses of humor. And, you have to a little when one of the psychics, is this too much of a spoiler, is a pet psychic.
Right. Which is so a thing I know exists, but I had sort of forgotten until, you know, I don't remember what the name of the pet is that the first person asks about, but I was like, oh, right. But again, it's like we just people really want to talk to each other. And honestly, that theme of trying to talk to the dead and get answers from them is replicated across multiple documentaries that I have seen at this festival. So clearly there's something there. But this is the only one that doesn't involve AI.
That's so interesting. Oh, I think that's also interesting. Yeah, because AI has become, I mean, like a lot of like technological inventions that are become really prominent, people seem to be incapable of imagining the world without it. To see a movie that, yeah, has absolutely no dependence on that. I mean, the way it opens, it's like this is a very cinematic opening to this movie. It's like Wings of Desire, basically. We kind of float in from the New York skyline. Yeah, it's more, I don't know, there's more of like an angelic kind of intelligence operating rather than artificial intelligence.
Yeah, exactly. And I would love to know how those it kind of zooms towards people's windows, what I am looking at right there,
Oh, yeah.
camera wise. I'm really excited to hear more about this film as it hopefully, you know, gets out there and more chatter about it.
Yeah. One last question. Have you been to psychics? Like, does this tally with what your experiences were?
I have never been to a psychic. I don't think I'm the kind of person who would seek one out. But I do feel like most people have a way that they try to, you know, get answers in life, no matter what it is. And certainly I am like probably everybody I know has at some time been like, I just wish I had like a sign, you know, or something happens and you're like, oh, that's like a sign I should do that. And I don't know that that's really more than a few ticks off of saying like, I just need my Nana to tell me that she's happy where she is. You know, it's like, it's very interesting. And honestly, very interesting. I have only just been thinking about this today, but very interesting in thinking about the fact that these are exactly the same questions that people approach AI replications of their loved ones with. So there you go.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there is a movie that is about that or has that?
There's two. There's two that I've seen so far, which I can talk about.
Yeah.
One is called Eternal You, and it's sort of a big picture documentary about the burgeoning technology of AI facilitated afterlife services, which is something 100% straight out of Black Mirror or any number of TV shows that I've seen. There was a show, is a show called Upload, I believe, that is on Amazon Prime, that's in its second or third season, which is the same idea, which is like, you know, this sort of long-running idea that we'll be able to upload our consciousnesses to a machine and kind of live forever. And in this case, it's people experimenting with how could a person who's alive upload themselves, you know, and their way of thinking, their speech patterns, what they know, to a system that then could kind of continue to live as them, as in our artificial intelligence, maybe a chat bot or something like that. And this, these exist. They're a big in Silicon Valley, as you can imagine. There's a lot of people trying to corner the market on this. But that documentary looks at it from kind of a sociological angle, and like Sherry Turkle is in it, and these other people who are trying to start these companies. And yeah, I mean, people talk very frankly about how, you know, I lost my husband and I wanted to talk to him. But of course, AI hallucinates and AI makes stuff up, and that is a major problem aside from all the ethical issues. And then there is another documentary that called Love Machina.
Oh yeah, that one I saw, yeah.
Yes, and that one is essentially about the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. The Martin and Bina Rothblatt are trying to create like a robotic bust, I guess, of Bina, who's very much alive. But the idea is that she will continue to live on and be able to interact with her descendants in some manner after she isn't alive someday. And I don't know, it freaks me out as a person who really is pretty resistant to this kind of stuff. But I think there's a moment in Eternal You where Sherry Turkle says something like, well, you know, it's just like basically people trying to use AI to do the same stuff that religion would have done in the past. And I was like, oh yeah, like that's kind of what's going on with the psychics as well. Not that psychic work hasn't existed, you know, parallel to religion for a long time, but there's definitely something there where it's like, we just have these big questions, we want them answered, and we want them answered in ways that are impossible. But maybe they're not impossible if we can talk to dead people. So
yeah,
that's all floating around at Sundance right now.
No, definitely. Yeah. And I mean, I have to say, when I was watching Love Machina, the vibe I was getting from that couple was it felt like a two-person religion, kind of.
Yes, very much.
And I think that's partly because, I mean, their kind of love language with each other, I guess, is it's just very absolute in both directions. So that kind of, and then the fact that they are going to these lengths. But I mean, that movie almost detours a little bit into Martine's career, which is just like, you know, just one of these people who just seems to go from one like reinvention to the like invented Sirius or something, the Sirius Radio XM or something.
Yeah. Invented XM radio or something like that. Also was like transitioned years ago, right. Landed on magazines for being a major CEO who also occupies the very rarefied space of not being a man,
right.
Which is like really fascinating. Also like did a bunch of pharmaceutical work, seems very interested mainly in things that can extend and change the lives of humans that also feel a little scary to humans, whatever that might be. They have a foundation that is named for a concept from Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower, like just very much forward-thinking people. I hope to never be a robotic AI bust. and the idea of that is disturbing for some reasons that are, I think, underexplored in Love Machina and explored more in Eternal You, although I think both docs are a little bit lacking in some ways. But I do think the ideas there are fascinating. And they're also fascinating just because this whole like talking to the dead stuff, that would have previously been basically the purview of the fiction side of the market at Sundance, and
right.
that it's all on the nonfiction side is just revealing of something.
Yeah. No, and I think it's a good thing to mention about Love of Machina that it's, yeah, not very skeptical. I actually think that some of the technology in there was in another documentary, maybe you saw it like Tribeca a couple years ago, that I think Crystal Moselle co-directed. You get a glimpse of one of the tech guy, but in that one, it felt more skeptical, like the effort wasn't going to work out, like they were kind of chasing some ghosts, you know, and it didn't really make sense in some way. So it was interesting, this almost like starts to rehabilitate that idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a whole other conversation. But maybe we can go to another documentary with maybe more recognizable quantity, that recognizable quantity being Will Ferrell.
Yes.
This is one I haven't seen, and I was just curious about it. I really didn't really understand quite what it is as a documentary, so I'm just curious for what your account of it is.
Yeah, it's a documentary that sounds like a bad idea to me at first. I feel like there's a lot of docs that have come out over the last few years, most of which honestly have been pretty forgettable, that I would think of as Looking for America docs, where it's like, oh, the country's so divided, let's go on a road trip and like look for America. And yes, the song does pop up in this one too. But the bigger concept behind Will and Harper is Will Ferrell is Will Ferrell. Harper was previously known as Andrew Steele, the head writer at Saturday Night Live throughout its kind of 90s aughts era, with the Tina Fey's and the Seth Meyers and the Bill Haders and all these people when they were all in the cast. So Harper came out as trans and started transitioning within the last 6 years or so, and sort of informed her family and then her friends. And Will was, you know, startled in part because, you know, they'd been friends for so long, and their experience of Harper was that when kind of living as a man, she was into like sports and like terrible dive bars and like the most awful grungy stuff and just like very kind of stereotypically masculine crap, essentially, and also loved taking road trips. And so Will suggested, and the film is a little vague on the details, but Will essentially suggested, why don't we like take a road trip together and let's film it and like make a documentary of it. And it's filmed by Josh Greenbaum, who you know, is an SNL kind of stalwart, but is probably best known as having, or best known to people like me as having, directed Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar.
Oh yeah.
A classic, a real, and also directed Strays, which I think came out last year early.
Oh, yeah.
The dog movie. Anyhow, I thought, well, this could be good, but it probably won't be, because that kind of premise usually tends towards sort of sappy, soppy nonsense in the end, a lot of like, and especially when you have two people who are, I mean, you know, let's be clear, Hollywood and media elites, kind of par excellence. These are people who've been at the apex of their craft for a very long time. You know, Will Ferrell is a genuine movie star who can go basically anywhere and get recognized. But that turns out to be kind of an interesting device, because one of Harper's main concerns is that she used to love taking these road trips, and now as a woman, the whole vibe has changed. Like, a woman cannot travel alone in America the same way as a man, but especially not a trans woman, especially not a trans woman who's like, who is recognized as trans. So they drive across the country, they visit different friends across the country, they visit like where Harper grew up, they visit her sister, they go to some dive bars, they go to a rodeo, and they end in California. And it actually, I think, for the most part, pretty much works. It's quite funny, which I guess you would expect from these two people, but it actually is quite funny. There's a lot of conversations that they have that you could only have between two longtime friends who are thinking about things like, well, what does it mean to be looked at, or what does it mean to be recognized, or these kinds of things. And there's a section where they go to, I believe it's Tulsa, and Harper is worried about going to this dive bar, and Will can't just walk into a dive bar and not attract attention, because everyone's like, oh, it's Ricky Bobby. So he stays outside in the parking lot, and Harper goes in and strikes up a conversation and decides it's fine and safe and texts him and says, come on in. And they have this like lovely time. They go to a rodeo. They have a lovely time. They have nice conversations with people and they go away. They start driving away and they're like, well, Harper's like, oh, that was great. I don't know what I was afraid of. And I was like, oh man, is this going to be one of those movies where it's like we went to a diner in Indiana and we decided that everyone in America is the
Oh,
same and
right.
we all need to but then they go to Texas to a steakhouse and have basically exactly the opposite experience, and it just added a layer of nuance that is usually lacking in this kind of a movie,
Oh,
I
wow.
think. Yeah, so it sounds like it could be either too sentimental or too kind of pedantic to be fun to watch, and I'm sure there are people who will find it to be both, but I was pleasantly surprised by it and thought, yeah, I think people will like this movie. And I think it also, for people who want to engage in that conversation, I think it's a pretty effective film. And it will get watched in part because Will Ferrell is in it more than it would if it was just like two random people. So I think that also makes it work. So yeah, I mean, I would say on the whole, Josh Greenbaum has a great eye for kind of what is funny and what will work. And it feels like it translated. There's definitely some scenes where I'm like, oh, I bet you some, but these are three very funny people who are plenty capable of coming up with funny scenarios on their own, and put them all together, and it's great. Yeah, so pleasantly surprised.
That's good to hear. Yeah, it's something I hope to catch up with. I mean, yeah, obviously one thing, which I was curious about is how genuine you can get or how unfiltered you can get when you are like a movie star like that.
Right. I mean, I think maybe on the plus side is that Will, I have, I've met Will Ferrell, I've interviewed him before, and he is like a genuinely sweet, nice guy. Like he seems like just kind of a dad who like accidentally became a star. And they talk about his early years on the show and everything in the course of it. But also, I think he's so used to being recognized and so used to being in front of the camera and like adopting a particular persona that he might be able to be more confident in being genuine in a movie like this than someone else would. He's used to the camera. Like, I don't think he feels it anymore. And that probably helps a great deal, I would think.
No, that makes sense. And yeah, I mean, I guess there's something about being a comic or a comedian that I mean, you can face plant. That's part of what you do.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah.
Exactly.
So that was a Will and Harper, and I think you mentioned that another movie you had seen was Girl State.
Yes.
And I want to catch up with that one too. I wasn't able to see it, but I had seen Boy State, which I liked. So I
Yes.
was very curious about Girl State.
Yeah, one of two Jesse Moss movies at
Oh, wow.
Sundance
Okay.
this year. Yes. He also has one called War Game. This
Right,
one
yeah.
he co-directed with Amanda McBain, who is both his working partner and his wife. And she is listed first in their pairing in this movie, which I think tells you something about what the content of the movie is. But so Boy State, people might remember, is it's a documentary about this summer program that the American Legion puts on for teenage boys, where they it's summer camp essentially on a college campus, but they sort of get to practice government for a week. They like elect representatives and a governor for this boy state, and they have to campaign and they learn a lot about the democratic process. And it's a very interesting film. You kind of meet these different boys and see the way that they're thinking. And it was a great movie. It was bought by Apple, I believe. You can still stream it there. So Girl State, as you might guess, is about the girls' version of this. And it is in Missouri this time. And it is actually kind of very coincidentally set during the week when the Supreme Court was about to hand down the Dobbs decision.
Oh, wow.
So that was not necessarily planned. I mean, that wasn't at all planned, but it, you hate to say it's serendipitous, but at least it worked for the film. So I think this movie's better than Boy State, not
Oh,
because of the
really?
filmmaking. I just think, yeah, I think it was able to take a broader, like, say some small things and some big things in a way that wasn't as obvious with Boy State. And the main reason I think is that it turns out Girls State is grossly underfunded compared to the equivalent Boise State in Missouri, at least, which was taking place on the same campus. And this starts to come into the storyline as the girls are realizing that, like, the boys over there, they're having these, like, really serious debates and discussions, and like having Congress people and the governor come visit the boys' state and meet them, you know, all this kind of stuff. And the girls' state one has something like a quarter of the budget. They're obviously not thrilled about this, but it's also just that the differences, I think, are super revealing. After I watched it, I told a friend, like, that was triggering to watch for me. And I just mean in a way where I was like, all this stuff you kind of forget about being a teenage girl. There's a lot of stuff that really sucks about being a teenage girl, but you know, you kind of forget that one of them is often feeling kind of inferior. And I think there's this cultural myth out there that like girls now are the ones who everyone focuses on and everyone's forgotten the boys. But I think this movie helps illuminate that that may not be as true as people want to say it is.
Right.
But the characters are very compelling. You know, teen girls have been maturing at a different rate than teen boys. So you get a very different set of like activities and dreams and even just sophistication in the way that they're thinking about like policy and politics and stuff like that. I really enjoyed it. I feel like there's a ton to unpack. I think I started watching it thinking like, well, this will be an easy watch. And then I sort of sat up straighter throughout the movie. And by the end, I was like, wow, that was a lot. But it is very fun to watch. This is a large group of teenagers who are just interested in thinking about how do you build consensus? Like, should you build consensus? You know, what does it mean to, there's one main character who you walk right in and she's like, I am a Christian, I am a conservative, and I am running for governor. And that's kind of like her leading foot. And it's interesting to see in Missouri, which actually these girls have a very wide diversity of opinions about everything, how that plays. Just what does that look like in 2023 and the kind of people who would go to this sort of a event. But yeah, I mean, where by the time they get to the end of the week and they're starting to get a little bit frustrated with the inequalities that they've noticed, you can even see some of the girls who maybe wouldn't have called themselves feminists on the way in starting to reevaluate what feminism is for and what it means on the way out. And in that way, I think that's really interesting. But it's also just such like a great concept for a film overall. Both of the two films as companion pieces, I think, you know, obviously it's a self-selecting group of teenagers who want to go to like a camp to pretend to have a government for a week. Yeah. That's not everybody, but they really are kind of all over the map. And the portrait, I guess if we're talking about portraits of America, I think the portrait of America you get, especially because we're talking about Missouri and Texas, which are two kind of famously contentious political states.
Right.
You get a really interesting, I am positive. Well, I shouldn't say that, but it would seem to me that this will definitely play at the True False Film Festival, given it's in Missouri.
Yeah, sounds safe bet.
If that happens, I am 100% going to go see it with an audience just because I'm dying to know what they think of it.
Oh, yeah.
But I really enjoyed watching it a lot and also felt a lot of things that I don't always feel when I'm watching a documentary, like anger and memories of being that age and just the kind of pressure that you put on yourself to be perfect, and how that can play out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I can't wait to see it now. I mean, that's...
Yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, Boys State, and I didn't mean to sound surprised when my reaction to that Girls State was better. It's...
Yeah, it's because Boys State's very good.
Yeah, but Boys State, it's good. But I think because I felt like with Boys State, it still was like in the universe of kind of contest documentaries in a way. And yep. So it was very much about like, in an interesting way, about like electoral politics, really, and cult of personalities and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it sounds like this one kind of has all sorts of layers beyond that.
Yeah. That's a great point. Yeah, the Boise State one definitely felt like it was inside of like the Spelling Bee documentary world or something like that. And this one, I mean, the contest is important and you're kind of rooting for someone at the end, but it's just interesting that they picked up very early on to the fact that the story here was not who wins, but something bigger and outside of the control of the filmmakers. It was, yeah, it was a really pleasant surprise to find that it wasn't a copy of Boys State. Not that I didn't think, I think Jesse and Amanda are very good filmmakers, but that it can also pull off being a crowd pleaser at the same time is really cool.
Yeah, no, definitely. So that's, yeah, Girls State, and there was like one other film that you liked.
Yeah, one last one that I think if I were taking bets on which one is still going to be making the rounds at the end of the year, and I mean that in a good way, people are going to be watching and talking about it, I think it'd be Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat. It is long, first of all. It's 2.5 hours long, which is always a little bit of a surprise in a genre that tends to be in the 90-minute range. But it's also just very complex. Like, I feel like I want to go back and watch it. It's not quite an essay film, but it definitely is more in the essay direction than a lot of these others. It uses all archival footage and tells sort of the story of 1960, specifically the coup in the Congo, as well as the relations between the Soviet Union and the US and the rest of the UN, as well as the jazz music that was happening at the time, and specifically the way that the CIA was, essentially not maybe tricking is too harsh of a word, but, sort of getting black jazz musicians from the US to travel abroad to kind of be cultural diplomats without realizing they were doing it at the beck and call of the CIA, which, you know, happened a lot in the arts. But I realized in talking to some people that this is still not really widely known by Americans, that this was a common thing that was happening in the 60s. But the film just feels like you're watching improvisational jazz. It's so interesting. And then often you see text on screen, but it's not just like quotes from the era. It's like text from history books and journalism, and there's footnotes. So it's got like a lot going on. I really enjoyed watching. I was totally overwhelmed. I'm going to have to go back and see it again. But I think it's kind of an achievement as a film. I love this kind of documentary. And it's like you're learning something. It's telling a story, but it's also trusting you to lean in and pay attention. And it's also kind of just a vibe. I mean, great music, you're really kind of feeling it while you're watching it. So I hope people are going to see it despite the length. And I'm really impressed by this one.
Yeah, I'm excited to finish it because I started it. I sort of picked it up, you know, and started it. And I was like, I can't absorb this right now. So I'm going to have to come back to it. But I just remember the editing being just wild. Like
incredible.
Very jazzistic, basically, if that's a word.
Yes. And because there's so much the whole thing wall to wall is just jazz music. There's, you know, that's all there is. So because of that, I would really recommend people try to see it in a theater if they can, or at least, you know, in a situation where you're getting really great audio, because it is going to be hard to watch at home, I think, but also because a great sound system will really punch up the experience.
Yeah. So yeah, that's Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat. I'm going to mispronounce his name, but Johan Grimon Perez. I tried.
Yep.
So yeah, we can wrap up with that. And I always like at the end to mention if there's any writing coming up.
Yeah, I will have a notebook on some of these coming up on the Times, I think this coming weekend.
Okay.
So, but people can find me at the Times all the time.
All the time.
We also have Oscar nominations this week.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Alyssa, for taking time to talk.
Thank you.
And yeah, have a good rest of the remote festival, as I will be having.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Stay warm.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with host Nicholas Rapol. You can support the podcast by signing up at rapol.substack.com. Thank you for listening.